Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. Today's show has two powerful guests well-known to the Chicago entertainment and media community. First half of the show, the entire first half, I'm going to be chatting with in-studio guest Billy McCarthy. He is a self-taught musician on drums and classical piano. He is well-known worldwide as the rock drummer and founding member of Atlantic recording artist Damals. This is going back to 1990, Damals off the Warped album and Down to Nothing. Billy joins us on the other side. To Nothing. 1990, that one came out. It's off the Warped album, Damals, out of Chicago by way of L.A. and signed to Atlantic Records. And keeping the beat on that song, one of the founding members of the group is with me right now, rocker turned author and documentary maker, and gosh, he's a little of everything these days. You're quite the artiste. Billy McCarthy is with us. Hey, Billy.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be here with you guys.
Now, back with Damals, you went by Billy Dior.
Yes.
Now, why did that name?
Well, it's weird because, with that whole era, I was Billy McCarthy until, 1985, because I was in L.A. before with another band, before I actually returned home without anything and then put Damals together. So it just wasn't cool for some reason. You know, somebody came up with this thing that everybody, from Poison to guys in everywhere, just like, you got to change your name. It's not cool. Billy McCarthy. It's too Irish, you know? It's not sexy enough. So, everybody else, had pseudonyms going on, a singer and bass player. So I said, I don't know what to do. So my sister, Mary, said, just use Dior, like Christian Dior. And I was like, okay, cool. Christian Dior. My singer was like, at the time, Desi, he was like, why don't you use Billy Beat? I go, I'm not going to be Billy Beat on the drums. That is not sexy.
So, no, not at all.
No. So then, went with the Dior and it had a nice, I think it rolled off pretty well. Billy Dior. I still get called Dior today. you know, by some of my friends. Mm-hmm. Hey, Dior, what's up? And, you know, when I make phone calls, it's kind of like the old, it's Billy McCarthy, used to be Billy Dior. So it's kind of confusing. And but I've been Billy McCarthy for the last 15 years, mm-hmm. 20 years, actually, and loving it.
Now, you've got a brand new book out. I love the title and I love the cover. It's called Beat Me Till I'm Famous. And, of course, you are a drummer. Yes. And it makes a lot of sense. But I like the cover. You're hanging on a drum here from Beat Boogie Drums, out of the South Side here.
That's right. Steve Crabtree. Steve Crabtree makes great drums, yeah.
He does. And you've got Ferocious Drummer, which is the name of your documentary, On the Drum.
Yes, that's a documentary that I started several years ago, actually. So I had a sideline to book Beat Me Till I'm Famous.
We have so much to talk about. This is a... it's a rather lengthy book. It's about 500 pages. Well, let's see, 441 pages.
Exactly, a little bit over 140,000 words.
Wow. How long of a process was this to make?
Well, you know, I wrote the book. It was sitting on ice for about 8 years because I wrote it. Yeah, I wrote it right in 2006, 2007. I began it, and it was pretty much edited up, ready to ship out in 2008. And I came up with this idea on doing a film about famous drummers, a documentary film. And then I passed it around to several legendary drummers, and they're like, "You got to do it, man." So then I put the book aside. And to answer your question, though, yeah, it was about a 3.5, 4 year process. It's about actually a year and a half to write, mm-hmm. and the rest of it is spent on editing. And then when you get down to the finish line, lots of copy editing and just inserting photos and everything. And it's really excruciating. The last like 90 days in a row, there's like literally like dozens of email exchanges going back and forth from your production team to you, mm-hmm. and it's overwhelming. But I'm proud of it. It's the proudest thing I think that I've done to date.
There's a lot of history in this. Personal perspective, actual rock and roll history. There's even a page where you've got a copy of my old Beat magazine cover that you were on, one of your bands.
That's right. I found that in some of my archives. And, you know, wow. Kevin Lee was one of the earlier artists before I went out to L.A., before I was 21, that I played with here in Chicago.
Was that with the Heartbeat?
Yes,
Kevin Lee
and
Heartbeat?
Yes, I was in Kevin Lee and Heartbeat. That was like my first real band with real management and recording studios, you know, outside of the original guys from my neighborhood, which were great, by the way. So when I found that, I was like, wow. I think that came out in 2005, right?
June 2005.
Yeah, it was a cover and Cheap Trick's on there and all the cool Chicago bands, and you were reminiscing about all the bands in Chicago. Yeah,
the headline is "No Power Shortage When It Comes to Chicago Pop." And there's the Elvis Brothers and The Kind and The Shoes, or Shoes, don't say the, Off-Broadway. and then there you are with Kevin Lee and Heartbeat. And
yeah.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. Oh, Gambler is in there. Gambler is actually in there. Wow, interesting stuff, say the least. So Chicago is a very rich music town. Always has been. If you go back to the 60s with Crying Shames and Shadows of Night and Ides of March and Buckingham's and Chicago and Rufus and Rotary Connection. I mean, the rich treasure of music we have here. This is a great city to grow up in if you're a musician.
Absolutely.
How did you fall into music? I mean, how did you embrace it? And at what age?
Well, you know, I mean, I listened to everything. I had an older sister that listened to, you know, Pink Floyd and Zeppelin and all that stuff. So I really started getting into the whole rock and roll thing late, like 15, 14. Okay. You know, one of my first favorite bands was Cheap Trick. And so basically, you know, I just picked up a set of drums when my parents were out of town when I was 17. They were in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I went to the store and I bought them, and I brought them downstairs and I set up. And in 3 days, I could play through Head Knocker by Foreigner.
Wow.
That was the first song I played through because I thought this is a real easy song. Let's just do it straight ahead. And then I became addicted to it. And, you know, I was like, you know, I got to get in a band. So then, you know, within a few months, these guys were playing around town, to make a long story short, let me in. My first gig that I realized this is what I wanted to do was M&R Rush. I contacted their keyboard player. In 1977. It could have been early 78. I'm not sure. Pretty much 77, though, I'll go with. I'd only been playing drums for like 7, 8, 9 months. And we had a cover band Well, I said, can we open up for you? Because my sister was a big fan of theirs, and she's my older sister. And she said, call Carl. Well, I'm on the phone with Carl, and I'm nervous. I'm thinking I'm talking to Greg Rolie from Journey, right? I'm like, yeah, we got a band. Can we open for you? He says, yeah. So we go to Argo High School. There's about 600 kids there screaming. And, we open up for M&R Rush. The band was called The Treats before Come On, Come On. It was one of my first bands. And we got done, and we're like, okay, let's take our equipment down so we can go down and watch M&R Rush, because that's really what we wanted to do. We just wanted to see M&R Rush. Mm-hmm. Rock and roll, Chicago! So we took our equipment down, went down, and sat in the front row to watch M&R Rush, and all these girls started rushing up to us, asking us for our autograph.
Wow. Great and, first gig.
Yeah, and that's when I thought, you know what? This is kind of cool. It's like chicks, equals, you know, drums, and it's good, you know? So that's when I first realized, you know, I think I really want to do this, because not because it's just the chicks, but it was like, hey, maybe I did something, you know, that it felt good playing in front of people. So then, you know, I was a very, very late bloomer. I mean, by the time I was 21, I was out in L.A., and I was, you know, 4 years later, I was recording with the producer from Jimi Hendrix and Frampton Comes Alive, you know, Eddie Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just like it came real fast.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought that he produced Kiss, Eddie Kramer. So I was like, oh, well, this can't be hard. I mean, you know, he produced those guys. I can get through this, right? And then after the session was over with, I found out it was Jimi Hendrix. And then I was kind of like, oh, God, am I glad I got my chops out of the way?
Yeah. So now you're self-taught.
Yeah.
So you picked up the Foreigner album, you learned Head Knocker, and mm-hmm. the rest is history. You're also self-taught on piano. Now, how did the piano come into play?
The piano thing is not, I don't do like recitals or anything like that, you know. It's just something that came real easy to me, you know. And you know, it is a percussion instrument,
mm-hmm.
so it kind of came real easy to me. I just diddle-daddle around, that's all I do.
Piano is interesting because it's a string instrument and a percussion instrument.
It is.
It can go either way.
Right. And I don't read music ever. I'm not condoning, you know, like saying that, you know,
you shouldn't
read music. But I've just strictly gone off of ear so for a long time. So, piano is just a diddle-daddle thing that, you know, I do. And I do come up with some pretty amazing stuff, you know, when mm-hmm. I'm in the moment. But I don't do it every day because, number one, my baby Gran has left me. Since, 2 years ago. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it's great. So, yeah, self-taught, that's the way I got through it. And with headphones, it only teaches you to play harder on a drum so you can hear yourself.
What's the hardest thing about what you've experienced thus far? Being a rock and roller, being a filmmaker, being a book author, being a radio show host yourself. Mm-hmm. What has been the most challenging aspect? Because it seems like the music came easy to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. The music came easy to me. I'll tell you what's been really challenging. You know, I know I've got a great film, Ferocious Drummers, that documents the time and period of each generation and the famous drummers behind those beats and how the music shaped our world and our culture and how the tempos actually, you know, came into all that play. But Ferocious Drummers is really, it's been hard. And I've realized over the last year and a half that I haven't, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm a mm-hmm. storyteller. You know, I saw Carmine Appice about 6 months ago in Chicago, and he said, what's going on with the documentary, man? And I'm like, you know, I'm trying to get a face. You know, I got a couple friends and this and that. You know, he goes, well, what are you going to do? I go, I need like $500,000. He goes, how do you know that? I go, I just think I do. He goes, well, you're not a filmmaker, man. You're a writer and you're a drummer, you know? And I go, you know what? You're right. I need to like find another producer to do this, you know, that knows film, mm-hmm. you know. I only know storytelling, and I know the story I want to tell, and I did all the interviews, so I know where I want it to go.
But it's the mechanics of
it. It's the mechanics of it, you know. To become a filmmaker is like something that you've got to just like dream of doing, and I've never dreamt of it. The only thing I dreamt of is the idea when I came up with it for the film,
mm-hmm.
and I had every drummer in the world calling me in my backyard in Palos Heights. It was like, you know, Max Weinberg, Simon Kirk, all these big time drummers. I'm on the phone with them and they're like, well, we heard about your documentary, man. We want to be in it. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And then, you know, from the first idea when it happened, it was a really easy thing to put together. In fact, you know, we did 4 locations. I've got over 60 hours of film, so it's really close.
Now, there's a Facebook page with some clips on it.
Yes, you can see the preview clip on Facebook. You look under Ferocious Drummers on Facebook. and you can see a preview of a trailer that's on there. I've got a lot of guys on there, I must admit, that haven't been uploaded yet. Mm-hmm. Like, I sat with Hal Blaine in Palm Desert, probably the Babe Ruth of drumming.
Oh, yeah.
I sat with him a few years ago, so we haven't put his individual kind of interview up there yet, you know, because we ran out of money.
Right.
So if there's any millionaires listening out there, we could definitely use some executive producing.
Now, have you thought of the GoFundMe type way of going about it?
Yeah, it's interesting you said that, you know, because we did do a Kickstarter thing, and it was probably at the wrong time and the wrong timing, because it basically got out of the gate with lots of mechanical problems. And when that stuff happens within the first 48 to 72 hours, forget about it, you know. And if you don't get every dime that you're going for on Kickstarter, which was, we were going for $150,000, mm-hmm. it's a lot of money. And, you know, I'm not so sure. I mean, you know, we tried it. We didn't make it. And, you know.
So if you don't make it, then you don't get any of it.
You don't get any of it. Right. And I didn't want to do anything like Indiegogo where, you know, if I get like $13,000, you know, well, we were going for $100,000, you know, but we only got 13. I'm not into that, you know, because it's like that to me just, it doesn't feel right. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I either go big or I don't go at all.
Okay.
You know, so I was, you know, and, you know, I don't know. I think I the Ferocious Drummers is timeless. The interviews are great. It's shot in the highest quality film. So we'll get there one day. I just got Beat Me Till I'm Famous off my plate, and that feels real good. But the story of the drummer definitely needs to be told, because, you know, there's just this misconception about drummers that are out there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, the only band that really did it right was Led Zeppelin. They quit when John Bonham died. And right. I know about a half other dozen bands that should do that right now. But, you know, in
the drummer's
opinion,
the heartbeat of the band.
It is the heartbeat of the band. And, you know, more so, you know, it's like the drummer's the glue that holds everything together, even emotionally, you know. You know, he's always a guy, you know, he's not the troublemaker. I hate to say it. Beat Me Till I'm Famous. If you got a lead singer, buy the book, okay? You know, lead singers are difficult, okay? And I don't mean that, you know, hey, you know, it's all their fault. I mean, do you know any lead singers that aren't difficult besides Robert Plant that said, hey, guess what? We're done. You know what I'm right. saying? Lead singers are very difficult, man. And it's the demise of every band that's out there. So, and, you know, when you're in a band, you know, it's hard being married to, you know, to one person. Try being married to three.
Right, right. And speaking of marriage, it's hard to be married at all when you're in the rock and roll business.
Yeah.
Because there's always those backstage bombers waiting for you. And on that note, let's go back to the Damals and the Warped album and its song, Backstage Bombers.
Just knock real hard and the doors are locked.
So that's you at the end.
Yeah, that was a fun track. I remember that track. We recorded that whole album in Sound City in California.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's the one you did with Kramer?
No, that was with Kevin Beamish.
Kevin Beamish.
Yeah,
okay.
Great producer. Love him. I haven't spoken to him in a while. He does all the Kenny Chesney stuff now.
And that's a big difference.
Yeah, I know. He did, at the time, he did You Can Tune a Piano, But You Can't Tune a Fish by REO.
Great album.
So, yeah.
Warped is the, was that the last album from the original lineup?
That was the last album.
1990?
Yeah, that was the one that was going to like, boom, this is where the big gold comes in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a shame. We finished it and we went home. And, you know, we had a little bit of turmoil right before we all went back to Chicago for a little bit. We were getting ready to shoot a video on Lake Michigan for one of the songs. I think it was most likely maybe The Answer. You know, we met with some video people. And then I got a phone. We got a phone call from somebody at Atlantic Records that says, hey, do you know your lead singer's playing with David Lee Roth, playing guitar? And I'm like, what? And it was weird. He jumped ship and actually played rhythm guitar for David Lee Roth. Didn't tell the band, didn't say anything. The album was getting ready to come out in like 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, but they did put it out, though. They put the album out, which is cool.
But he didn't want to do both bands.
No, he just jumped ship just to be like, you know what, I think it's cool to jump ship. I mean, after you spend like a year and a half on one of the best rock albums.
Why would any musician, especially a lead singer, want to play rhythm guitar in another guy's band when you could be the lead singer of your own band?
Well, I think he was basically, in my opinion, he was setting up to be a solo artist. He thought, if I can get on stage with Dave and open up my funnel a little bit more, which is sad, you know, because there's nothing greater than having a band and a force behind you, you know, to actually, like, take it all away. Because if you got four guys that want it, you're going to get it,
right.
You know? So that was his thing, you know. I mean, I was driving home from the Rosemont Theater with Janie Lane from Warrant. They just got done opening up for Motley Crue, and him and I were in a limo. We were going down to Excalibur after the concert, and I played him our demos.
This album here?
Yes, this album, okay. Warped. And he said, you know, he goes, you're going to be a really rich kid, man, and I'm happy for you in about a few months. I said, really? He goes, yeah, this album kills. He goes, this album is absolutely killer. So anyway, so that's the thing that happened. So when it was all over, it was kind of like a sigh of relief, like, oh, okay. Because there's a lot of drama inside Beat Me Till I'm Famous that, you know.
Yeah, unfolded. There's a lot of stories in there. We're going to get to a couple of those in a minute. But we just got a surprise call from someone from your past. It's kind of like that old TV show, This Is Your Life. Say hello, mystery guest.
Hello, Billy?
Yes.
And there's a second mystery guest, too.
Okay.
Hello, Billy Dior.
Hi, who is this?
This is your life, Billy McCarthy.
Wait. Blast from your past, from 1978 through 1981.
Oh, wow. This is funny. This is Donnie Rosinski and Frank Sintich. These guys are the ones that I played in Come On, my first band that I actually had a cover band I played. Hey, guys. How are you?
We're good. How are you?
I'm good. Good to hear your voices here. That's funny. See, they were listening.
Yeah.
People do pay attention.
I wanted to shout out to Tom Lounges, too. I haven't seen him since Point East.
Oh, my gosh. I was a youngin' back then.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what are you guys doing?
Well, I'm in Chicago, and Donnie's in
Chicago. And I'm in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. So you got on the phone and you say, that guy better plug our band because we're coming back with a vengeance. But hey, man, great hearing from you guys, man. What a pleasant surprise. You know, Donnie was one of the biggest guitar players in town. He taught Chip Zanuff how to play drums, bongos, and he let me in his band because I told him I've been playing for like 3 years. Man, I'm ready, you know. And he was the guy that was playing for years. So he gave me...
I took Chip off bongos and put a bass in his hands.
Yeah, he put a bass in Chip's hands. And thank you, Donnie, for giving me the opportunity because, you know, he gave me my first opportunity, you know, to play. And we were playing UFO and everything like that. But it's great to hear from you guys.
Maybe we should get the band back together.
Yeah.
I've been pushing for a reunion gig for about 5 years now. Haven't I, Frank?
Well, Tom, I'll tell you a quick story.
Okay.
So Tom and I know each other because, you know, I've been producing shows at the Acorn Theater in Three Oaks, Michigan now. It's a not-for-profit, 300-seat little venue. It's a great venue. And Tom has been so kind to promote some of the artists that I've booked there in the last year. So, but that's how we know each other, and you guys know each other in a whole different way. But so, Tom, real quick story. So, so there was two factions of this band, Come On, Come On, and Billy left the band to pursue, you know, rich and famous career out on the West Coast, which, which he's telling you the story about. And so there was a second faction. So we did a couple shows, you know, and we recorded some of these shows on cassette. Okay, so years, and I had these two cassettes in all the cars that I had over the years. I kept them in my console. So 5, 6, 7 years ago, I saw these two tapes. I said, "Look, I got to do something with these tapes, or they're going to just turn into mush." So a buddy of mine has a recording studio, and he's got all the cool toys, and brought it to him, and he transposed them down to digital. And I could have spent a lot more time and money to really, really fix them. But I made two CDs, and I created like liner notes and pictures of the band. And I sent them to these guys with a little story about the band. And they were totally shocked when, of course, you guys can talk about that. I mean, it was really fun to bring back that time in our lives when we were just little kids, 20-year-old kids, playing these shows. And we were really into it, man. We had posters and, Billy was good at promotion. Billy was our promo guy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fun.
I think it's great that you guys called up. That was a nice little surprise.
It is nice. You know what's great? It's like we still talk to each other, you know, all my bandmates and stuff. You know?
Were just talking about how the drama in the bands, and now here's two guys that call out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Still friends with. There's only one person we don't really contact anymore, you know, but, you know, we all stay in touch with each other, and it's great that everybody's still alive and doing well. These guys are great. Thanks, guys, for calling in, man. I really appreciate it.
Have you read his book yet?
You're very welcome. I read Billy's other book, but I haven't read this one yet, so I'm looking forward to I want to get an autographed copy. I don't know what it's going to take.
I have a couple autographed copies coming, and I'm coming to town to Chicago from the 22nd through the 25th.
All right.
Through the 24th.
Let's get together and have a drink, all of us, okay?
Yeah, let's connect on Facebook. Be good to see you after like 40 years since Point East.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Although I can't drink like I used to. I may have one. All right. Thanks,
Tom,
guys.
Good to hear your voice again as well.
All right. Stay in touch and let's hook up.
All right. We'll do it. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Take care. Good luck, you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Rock on.
Wow, that is cool. I'm looking. Tom hands me the note. I'm like, oh, this is like a blast from the past.
Yeah, that was. Those guys are funny.
So, see, people do listen to radio still.
Yeah, they
not
still
everyone's
do.
On Pandora.
That's right.
And it's interesting. Now we're gonna actually give a copy of the book away a little later in the show. So I want you to write this number down and get ready to give us a call when we tell you to, if you want to win the book. He's going to sign a copy for you. It's 219-769-9577. That's 219-769-9577. Write that number down. We'll tell you when to call. We have one copy, and someone's going to get it. And it could be you, but you got to be quick on the dial when we tell you to call. Now, you were talking about the book, obviously, right. The brand new book, Beat Me Till I'm Famous, which chronicles your story from a local Chicago guy that we just talked about with Come On, Come On, and the different things you were doing. Let's take the trip to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Pick it up here. What made you decide to chase the dream to L.A., and was it all you thought it would be? Because it sounds like there's some dark stuff in this book.
Yeah, there's some dark stuff for sure. Well, you know, things happen in phases. You know, you either leave a band or you get fired from a band. Or you quit, you know? So I was in transition from Kevin Lee and Heartbeat. And then I got together with Chip, and him and I had a three-piece band with Desi, who would become my future lead singer in DeMalls.
Now, that's not the We're Staying thing, is it?
No. But it was just the three of us. We were heavy. We were hot. We were like, we sounded like Green Day meets Nirvana in 1980 or 81, right when it turned that corner. So anyway, to make a long story short, Desi, my singer, and I and Chip were going to go out to L.A. as a three-piece. And then I got wind that Desi was up to something else that, you know, I didn't agree with. And I was like, you know what, dude, I am not going to L.A. with you. There's no way. I get a phone call after him and I have that discussion. I go, I'm out. And Chip says, I'm out. I'm staying here. I'm going to have a kid. You know, I can't go. So I said, fine. That was fun for like 4 months in my bedroom rehearsing. So I got a phone call from these guys from L.A., and they're like, they were from Chicago originally. They were called the Hollywoods, and they were called Kid Rock, or they were managed by Bill O'Coin, who discovered Kiss, Billy Idol. And they said, hey, man, you know, they knew me from the scene. I had gone out with this singer's girlfriend. They knew me from Kevin Lee and Heartbeat, and they said, we need a drummer. Would you come out? And I'm like, sure, man, I'm in. You know what I mean?
I applied for Bill O'Coin management at one time, and you sent me a pink slip, said no.
Oh, that's funny. But anyway, so I got out to L.A. So, yeah, I jump on a plane. I'd never been on a plane before, ever in my life. Here, I'm 21. I flew Capital Airlines. You remember that?
Yeah.
I was on Capital Airlines. It was really bouncy and shaky up there. I arrived in L.A. with $500. They got off the plane. Those two guys showed up, Jimmy and Trace. They were from Chicago. One guy was – Trace was in a band called The Phonics at one time.
I remember those guys?
Yep. And then Jimmy was – a great band called The Hollywoods. You remember The Hollywoods?
That doesn't ring a bell.
The best pop songs you ever heard in your entire pop song life, okay? This band was better than Enough's Enough, better than Pez Band, better than all these bands when we were on. I'm not exaggerating here. I mean, Ronnie Youngkins from Kix, he left his group to play with Kid Rocker before we even had a record deal. That's how good our songs were, but we just couldn't get over the finish line because we had so many guitar players that would come in and be like, you know, I got a song. And Jimmy was like this great songwriter, and he's like, I don't need your songs, man, I got the songs, you know. But it was a great pop band, and that's how that happened, you know. So
you got to LA, and that band didn't take off as far as a record label.
No, we had everything going for us. I mean, we even did Star Search.
Did you really?
Well, we didn't perform on it. Okay. No, we got fired, actually. We didn't make the audition. It was really funny. There's a hilarious story about Star Search in the book. But no, we went through, it was again, and I don't mean to keep harping on it, but it was like a thing with the lead singer kind of thing, letting everything unravel, you know. Bill O'Coin, there was a couple things that really tore that band apart. And it wasn't anything like, you know, I hate you. Then I got done with that band, and that's when Cece DeVille and I put together Screaming Memes.
I remember that.
And we did Talk Dirty to Me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was great. It was like, that was like one of our signature songs at the end of rehearsal. Let's do Talk Dirty to Me, you know, and we can always get through that song, right? We were a powerful four-piece band, though. We just couldn't find a singer. You know, had we found a singer, Herman Rarebrough used to come down to our rehearsals from the Scorpions. He'd be like, if you guys could find a singer, you're going to be bigger than The Alarm. You know, the band The Alarm.
That was Mike.
In Hanoi Rocks.
Yeah, The Alarm.
Yeah,
Mike Peters.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we tried that. And then, you know, at that point, it was kind of like, Kid Rocker made it to like the best of LA's unsigned bands from The Troubadour. We made it to that album, you know. And our only competition at the time, believe it or not, was a band called Candy. And Gilby Clark was a guitar player in that band. It was a ghost town. I mean, Motley Crue lived below us. You know, Tommy, Nicky, and Vince lived the apartment below Kid Rocker. They were just like coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And we would all hang out and stuff. Nikki would come over all the time and borrow tinfoil and use our phone. And his girlfriend at the time was Lita Ford.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I remember little chubby Lita. You know, right? She was cute, you know, little chubby but cute. And it's okay. I like chubby. It's good. That was the whole scene then. It was like a ghost town. It was like, man, if you want to be big and make it, go out there. Like if Enough's Enough would have arrived, they would have just blew the town up overnight. You know, because they're just a great band,
right.
You know. But the songwriting was really, really good in Kid Rocker. And I didn't even mess with it. I was like, I'm out of here, man. You just do your own songwriting. It's great. I help with arrangements. That was my forte. But, that's how it all happened, you know. And then just like I'd never been to L.A. before. And I got out there and I was like, wow, this is wild.
So you're 19, 20 years old?
I'm 20. Just turned 21.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, just turned 21, and, you know, these guys were from Chicago, and we had each other's back, you know what I'm saying? And it was great, because even though we were strangers, we didn't really know each other that well, we were just like total brothers, man, once we got together, and it was like a real good force, you know?
So how did that evolve into Damals?
Well, what happened was Desi came in the picture when we had Eddie Kramer. We needed another guitar player. It was like the sixth guitar player we needed within like 2 years, right? So then Desi says, you know, I could play rhythm guitar. So then Desi starts playing rhythm guitar for Kid Rocker. And we caught him up to no good after we produced a demo with Eddie Kramer and, you know, and Bill. You know, him and the singer that we had, Jimmy, they sounded like Simon and Garfunkel together. Mm. Their harmonies were incredible. We sounded like the Raspberries.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
If you go online and listen to Girls Like the Beat, you know, that's a great song, you know? I mean, it's one of our songs that were like, that should have been a massive hit. So they sounded great together. Desi got up to no good. We had to fire him. So we just said, you're out. You know, right when it was all going down, too, because Bill was like, why is your guitar player coming to Eddie Kramer and going up to the Whiskey A Go-Go trying to book his band a solo act when he's in Kid Rocker? You know, this is not cool. This does not ring well, you know. And we're like, yeah, why is he doing that? Well, apparently he's up to no good again. So got rid of him. And I went home after Screaming Memes and... Chip said, you know, Desi's back too. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he's like, yeah, why don't you give him a call? So I said, well, I don't know. Why didn't he call me or something? So Desi called me. We got together. We made amends. And, you know, there's no bad blood between Desi and I. I don't not like wish the guy get hit by a car or something like that. Right. You know, we just don't speak anymore just because we just don't speak. There's no hatred. I'm not a hatred kind of guy, you know. And, you know, I took my licks and got up and did it again. And that's what you should do. You know, so anyway, we just ended up being, he goes, hey, I got this band, it's, you know, and, you know, we're in the early stages of it. It's called Demals. And I'm like, the who? Demals, the who? That was the main question everybody would ask. And we dress in women's lingerie. And I'm like, I got to think about this one, you know?
Right.
So I said, yeah, well, how about if I wear a suit? Wouldn't that be cool? The drummer in the back, and then you guys put the lingerie. Nah. We got to do it. So anyway, we did it, and the rest is history. We went out to L.A. We
kind of started a trend. I mean, New York Dolls started it, really, and, yeah. And you know, a little bit with the Spiders of Mars from Mars and Bowie. But you guys kind of took it to the next level, and then it became trendy in L.A. So you almost kind of kick-started that.
We kind of did. Poison was doing a little bit, you know. They were real scantily dressed, but they had like more glam and glitz going
right.
on. Yeah, we did, but you know, it became to a point where it was fun and exciting at first. I mean, our first gig, everybody was there. Vinnie Vincent, Mark Slaughter, Tammy Downs from Faster Pussycat, Ricky Rackwin was there. You know, everybody was there. Lon Friend from Rip Magazine. It was packed. I mean, it was our first gig in Hollywood, was a sellout, you know? And I remember we were in a limo and the door opened and this guy, our road manager came and he said, I can't believe how many industry people are in there. That place is loaded. Because we put a billboard up before.
Which is in the book.
Yeah. No, that's the radio billboard.
Oh, that's the radio
billboard. Yeah, we put a billboard of the poster that's in the book on Sunset Boulevard, so. And it, when we got out there, everybody was like, "We got to see these guys." But see, we could play. We were really good at our instruments, so it was even more powerful.
Right. Now, you did two albums.
Yeah.
And then wasn't there like a best of or a compilation of some sort?
Yeah, that's just outtake stuff, though, that like one take stuff that on our demos that somebody put it together. So I don't encourage anybody to buy that because it's all bootleg and I haven't gotten a royalty from that yet.
Okay.
You know? So we just did two albums and that was it. The first album. But it's really I call it a dark comedy, the book. It's interesting how everything came about, you know.
Oh, okay.
Kind of doing that. So
we're going to pause in Hollywood right now. We're going to talk about some of the famous folks one of the famous folks you lived with for a while, famous comedian on the other side here. And we're going to talk about some of your favorite bands and some of the more memorable gigs. But first, let's say hello to another member of your entourage, I guess you'd say, that we just mentioned on air. Mr. Steve Crabtree is on the phone. Hey, Steve.
Oh. Hey, Steve. Hey, Steve. How are you? How you doing?
All right, you're the man.
Billy, thank you. Thank you, Steve. Boy, everybody's getting their licks in today, Tom. I love it. Hi, Steven.
A great book. The trailer for Ferocious Drummer is, like, exceptional. So it's all good.
Now, for the listeners that are wondering who Steve is, he's the guy that designs the drums we were just talking about, Beat Boogie drums. And you can see one of them on the cover of the book, Beat Me Till I'm Famous. Steve, you've been a drummer a long time, formerly with Mammoth. You've played with so many different talents over the years. What is it about Billy as a drummer to drummer that makes him a standout? We'll put you on the spot here.
You know what? He's just himself. He's a natural. And, you know, he's a great communicator. Even without talking.
Sometimes it's hard to make him not talk. He's got so many stories. Well, you know, you got this great drum on the cover that that he's hugging on the cover of this book here. What when you customize a drum for different musicians, different drummers, how do you get to know what drum works with the right musician? Do they help you design it? Do you just kind of get to know them and say, I think this drum's going to work for your sound? How does that work?
Yeah, he was kind of giving you an idea of what he was looking for, so we went with mahogany shells, and then we did the custom laminate with the Ferocious Drummer logo on all the drums. So it really turned out nice.
Go ahead.
There's going to be some nice surprises down the road coming up with Billy and that drum kit.
Oh, okay. Well, Billy seems to really love his drums in a very unique way. There's a picture in the book that you said is a drum that you had early on, and you still have it.
Yeah.
Like from early in your
career. Yeah, the first time I ever realized. It's funny.
Actually, it's on the first album.
It's on the first album. Yeah, I had gone into my neighbor's bedroom, and he had an old red set up, and that's one of the tom-toms, and I just sat down and started wailing, and then when I looked up, there was half the high school kids were in the hallway down the hall, and they were cheering, and I never played a drum in my life, a real drum, until then. I don't know what I was doing. I was doing triplets or something like that. It was kind of like riding a bike. So that's, I think, when I first realized, wow, I could do this, you know?
If you look at the back of the first album from 1988, he's carrying the drum, like a little drummer boy.
Yeah, I still have that drum in my garage.
That's fun.
So I hope you hang on
to those.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I die, I mean, I hope they throw it in a coffin or something. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I shouldn't talk about that now. I still have to go through I-80.
Well, Steve, anything you want to say to Billy real quick?
Yeah, just don't do the water trick on the drums and use the fire.
Thanks, Steven. I really appreciate it. You're great. Thank you, man. Thank you.
Now, all right,
Steve,
talk to you.
Thanks. Great. Thanks for calling in, buddy.
Hey, before we let you go, Steve, real quick, if there's any drummers listening out there that are interested in custom drums, give me your website.
Beatboogie.com.
And just ask for Steve, and he will fix you up just
Killer.
Like he did Billy.
Killer
right,
drums.
We're all over Facebook, too. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in.
All right. Nice talking to you guys.
Thanks,
nice
Steve.
Talking with you. Again, keep that number handy. And just a little bit here, we're going to be giving that copy of the book away. One copy only. You got to be quick on the dial. So in just about 10, 15 minutes, we'll be opening up the phone line. So listen for your cue to call at 219-769-9577. 219-769-9577 is the number you're going to call. And you'll win a copy of the book signed by Billy just to you because you're so special. And we're picking up in L.A. You're there. You're starting to get successful. Mm-hmm. The industry has turned out for DeMahl's first gig, and you're about to be signed.
Yeah.
Now, you do two albums. Why did it end for you after the two albums? 1990, band fell apart. Why not stay out there? Why not continue on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll tell you, that's a fantastic question. Here's the deal. I was getting into producing at the time, toward the end of DeMahl's, when we were still recording our album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in Chicago. I grew up with, like, the best musicians around. And I don't know how to say this because I don't want to offend a lot of musicians in L.A. because they're basically transplants anyway. Mm-hmm. They come from all over the country. It just wasn't one of those things where, like, you had a circle of people that were, like, into, like, getting together and doing bands, hanging around street corners like you do in Chicago. Everybody was in a band or they were trying to put another original band together. Seattle came along, okay? And it was like the dark days, you know, in like 91. I'm not accustomed to that kind of music. You know, I'm from like pop melody, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Roots from the Midwest. So it was very hard to me to adjust to that stuff. I played it well. I liked playing it. But I just didn't want to put a band together, so to speak, to do that. And DeMahl's was just kind of like, it was just so draining, the final hours of it, that it was like, okay, I think I can do this producing thing, you know, for a while and be happy.
And did you stay in L.A. and do it?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I stayed in L.A. and I produced. And then that's when I met this artist, this kid by the pool at the Oakwoods. We used to all lounge at the Oakwoods like a bunch of lazy dogs on a Saturday. We were signed to Atlantic Records, free money, free cars, everything, right? So, you know, all of us would be laying around at the Oakwoods, and, you know, CeCe DeVille would show up and Ron Jeremy. Then you had UFO across the way, you know, Michael Schenker and, you know, Pete Way lounging. Pete lived in a bungalow over there, and Michael lived next door to us. And we would all just be lounging around, and there was this kid there, and it was like, you know, I became friends with him. I'm like, what do you do? He goes, oh, I'm going to college, you know? And he goes, I just got out of college. I go, okay. He goes, I'm just sitting around watching you barbarians, you know, eat like a bunch of, you know, monkeys, you know, with your salami sandwiches and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, cool. So we became friends, him and I, you know, like his name was Brian. And I found out a couple weeks later it was Rodney Dangerfield's son.
Wow.
So, you know, he knew about the whole rock thing. He thought we were comical. Demalls, you guys are a comedy, man. He used to say all the time, you guys are just a comedy, man. There's so much dysfunction going on in your band. That Lizzie over there and Desi over there. And so he brought me up. We went to, you know, he brought his guitar down. And, you know, he said, hey, he goes, you into this? And he started playing some stuff for me. And I was like, this kid is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I was like, the last thing I wanted to hear was like a Bob Dylan, you know, Grateful Dead kind of thing, you know. But like he was singing and playing. And he goes, you think so? I go, you're good. I go, you're real good, you know. And he goes, wow. And him and I became best friends from that moment. So then I started taking his songs from the acoustic in the closet when he was playing, to putting real production to it. And I worked with him for about 10 years. And,
did anything get released?
Yes, it did. It's funny because, you know, the first song we recorded ever when he walked into a recording studio, we did it in Calumet Park where I lived with my parents. He had a song called She Was My Harbor. And I remember when we did the song, I said, you know, I think I can get this in a movie soundtrack. I don't know what movie soundtrack. I've never gotten anything in there, but I think I can do it. So to make a long story short, the Tribune ran something. Rodney Dangerfield's son, Brian, is staying with Billy Dior from DeMalls. They're recording something at Star Trek Studio, which is Jeff from M&R Rush, in Orland. And the song is called She Was My Harbor. Well, we got done recording She Was My Harbor. I went back out to L.A. I give it to Michael Lippman from Lippman and Kahane. He manages George Michael, his staff. She takes it. She says, this is great. Boom. We're in a Dennis Hopper and Archer movie right away.
Wow.
Yeah, right. It just happened so fast. Next thing you know, I got Warner Chappell calling me up. They want to meet with Brian. And I did all the production on his stuff. He would come up with the riffs on the guitar, and I would hire all the musicians. Okay, I want you to play 16th notes here, you know, on the mandolin through this chorus. Okay, you do this, you do that. I didn't even drum on this stuff. I drummed on maybe a couple tracks because I wanted to be away, you know what I mean, and make sure everything went good. But kid was brilliant. He's brilliant. But he just had a fear that, you know, his dad was king. You know, Rodney's king. I'm king, man. You know what I mean? What's that music stuff you're doing, man? What are you cats doing?
No respect.
Yeah, what are you cats doing, you know? And Brian was like, you know, figuring out this way, how can I convince my dad that I'm not going to be a psychologist like he wants me to be because I just graduated with top honors at NYU? How can I convince him I really want to be like Bob Dylan?
Right.
Right? And it was a really strange thing. So then, you know, for the last 10, 11 years, all I did was I hear about, oh, him. Yeah, he called and this and that. Now I got to go to dinner with him tonight. Now I got to do this. So I was like, I was part of the family because I would hear constant stories. We would record in Westport, Connecticut at Rodney's house. You know, we had carte blanche to his house, you know.
Wow.
He had a pool there that was like bigger than like the Holiday Inn pool, you know, at a local Holiday Inn.
How much was Rodney Dangerfield the man like Rodney Dangerfield the entertainer as far as the persona we see?
That's a great question, you know, and I said it in the book, you know. The first time I actually had, when we had dinner with Rodney, and I walked in, and, you know, he's sitting there and he's rolling the biggest, can I say it, the biggest joint? Sorry.
Okay.
And, you know, at his table in Westlake, you know, and in California. And, like, he's just beyond cool. He's, like, the coolest guy I ever met, and I met a lot of guys, like, you know, big guys that were in entertainment business. He was the coolest guy. And surprisingly, he's a very good-looking guy. You know, people used to make fun of his looks all the time.
Right.
Oh, Rodney, you know what I mean? And his wife was on fire hot, so smoking hot. When she came in, Joan, and we saw, you know, him and his wife was like 42 at the time. I think he was like 65. He's just cool. He just had a real cool demeanor about him.
And you spent a lot of time with him then?
Well, not a lot of time with him. Yeah, just basically like talking on, you know, hey, is Brian there? You know, when he was in New York and I was in Chicago. And then we went, when we lived together, we lived at his house. He lived in L.A.
Okay.
So he had people watching his house, but we had his quarters, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
His bedrooms and everything. Then we went to New York, and we lived there, too, as well, at the penthouse he had in New York.
Wow.
So it was quite a, yeah.
Speaking of famous friends, not quite as famous as Rodney Dangerfield or Cheap Trick or some of the others, but one of the probably one of the best hard rock bands of Chicago, in Chicago history, was Holland. Tommy Holland
Love
and
Holland.
The Boys. They were amazing. We've got a song that we're going to do from Little Monsters. I remember doing the Little Monsters release party at Hegwisch Records.
Oh, my God.
And Tommy and the guys were there, and we were playing as a manhole cover with a claw coming out. Mm-hmm. And it was mobbed. Why do you think – what did you work with them in a capacity of some sort, or were you just friends?
No, we were just friends. Like, okay. I knew, like, yeah, I knew him from the scene. That was it. So we were just friends. What? Tommy was signed before all of us.
Why do you think they didn't hit? I mean, their stuff was in movies. I mean, they were in movies as far as soundtracks, but they were huge.
I know why. I think I know why. Well, let's start with the fact that Atlantic Records burned two Chicago bands that were great. You know, they burned Holland and they burned off Broadway.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And the reason they did is because neither of those bands had strong management. Now, you know what I mean? I think, did Ken Animani manage off-Broadway?
Off-Broadway, yeah.
He did. He did manage off-Broadway.
And he had
You're
Cheap
right.
Trick.
You're right. You're right. But Cheap Trick was his thing. I don't know what happened with those bands, but I think it was a different time period. I know that, you know, management is really crucial when you get a record deal. It's the most crucial thing you can have. You know, you got to have, because the label's going to give you all the money, and you better spend it correctly.
Right.
I think that's what happened with Tommy was, you know, they were in Chicago. When you're in Chicago and you got a record deal, people can get away with a lot of stuff that you don't know about, as opposed to being up in their office and making sure that everything's cool and kosher without pestering them. So, you know, that's why we were out in LA, because like we wanted to be in LA, you know, be close. Although I do admire these bands, like, who's the big band? Danny Donegan. What's his band?
Oh, Disturbed.
Yeah, I mean, give it to those guys, man, for being in Chicago. And Chip.
Well, Danny's still in Chicago. I think the rest of the guys are in
Yeah,
LA.
Great guy, by the way, Danny Donegan. And Chip, too, is enough. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, they.
Stay local.
I was really envious of those guys. They got to stay in Chicago. That was cool. You know what I mean? But, you know, I just don't think they had the right management at the time. And I say Ken Animani is the best manager to ever come along. So,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, he was very good.
I think that was the problem, man, with I think that was a problem with Holland. I thought Holland was great.
Well, let's let the listeners decide. If you've never heard Holland, these guys are right here out of South Chicago. And the album was called Little Monsters. You can still get it online. They had two big songs, Wake Up the Neighborhood, which was included in some film soundtracks, and this one, which kicks off the album. It's a great one. It's called Lovin' on Time.
Jet lag.
Going back to the Little Monsters album, Holland, a great Chicago band signed to Atlantic, just like my guest, Billy McCarthy with Damals. And we're talking about some of the great Chicagoland bands and another one along like Off-Broadway and even The Kind, all these great bands that never really got out of the Midwest. It's a real shame.
Yeah, it is.
You guys had your shot.
Yeah.
And you did fairly well. And then it kind of imploded like so many bands do.
Yeah. Yeah, we were pretty huge in L.A. when we first got there. We really, the only place we played out in Chicago was we did the Thirsty Whale Friday, Saturday night, but then we did the Riviera twice, and that was it.
Mm. What was one of the biggest shows you did as far as Damals?
Well, probably the biggest one was it wasn't that big. I mean, I guess it was 12,000. It was with Honeymoon Suite.
I remember that.
In, I think, Phoenix, Arizona. It was a big festival.
I remember their album cover. They had a bed of nails with satin sheets on it. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was the coolest album cover.
Yeah. So, yeah, we did that. And then one of my most memorable gigs was the Santa Monica Civic Center. We played in California. We did a bill with the Bullet Boys.
I remember them.
And then Tough opened up for us. Yeah. And, it was like us. It was Tough, Damals, and then it was the Bullet Boys. What a great show that was. That room was incredible, man. So, that would probably be the biggest things, you know. But we did a lot of club dates in L.A., but we never played to less than capacity, which was cool.
Now, the 80s is, you know, Motley Crue defined it as the decade of decadence. I mean, how decadent was it really? You were an insider working and hanging with all these guys. Was a lot of that just flash and image, or was it really a down and dirty, seedy business?
Nah, it was overhype.
Okay.
Totally. I mean, you know, I had a period where I did my drugs, you know, not drugs, but I did my, you know, I was, you know, well, I'm just going to drink today for the next 2 weeks. You know what I'm saying?
Just things because
aren't
I can.
Going, yeah. And things aren't going well, you know? So, but as far as like, you know, people want to believe like, you know, oh, you got wasted and you went on stage. And, you know, that, as I address in the book, that doesn't happen. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can't be that wasted and go on stage and play, because you're not going to make it and you're going to get fired. And if your band doesn't fire you or warn you about it, the management will, because the management has a big stake. You
right.
know?
There's a lot of money involved.
There's a lot of money involved. So people like to live that whole image. Now, I'll tell you what, when we got off stage, the game was on. Okay. When we had our, that's the problem with Damals. We had too much time on our hands.
Not touring enough?
Oh, yeah. All we did was sit around and, like, figure out, you know, how we can, like, you know, destroy things, literally, you know. You know, I don't like the way this one's looking this week, and this one's talking this week, and this one's, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just always drama. It was, like, beyond belief. And it was like we should have just been on the road and playing and playing and playing. I mean, we'd get done with a gig. We'd sit around for, like, 6 weeks till another gig happened. We were getting paid.
Wow. Idle time.
Yeah, we were getting paid to do nothing, you know? And then it was like, oh, we got to interview some producers, you know, for our next album. And then, you know, we did a short tour, you know, with Warrant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was very short. And then they jumped ship. They jumped after like the sixth, seventh date. So we finished a tour. We were supposed to go to England. We're pretty big in England, actually, to be honest with you. We were bigger in England than we were in the States at one time.
That happens with a lot of bands.
Yeah, Chip.
If you go to Zenuff, you go to Japan. He's huge. He's a god there.
Yeah, Chip tells me all the time. He goes to Italy and he goes to England. He says, "Yeah, I just walked in the bar and I was playing Damals," you know. And you know, Kerrang magazine, one of the biggest magazines in rock, they loved Damals. I mean, mm-hmm. they gave us like 4 stars right off the bat. They were huge fans of Damals, so it was nice to hear that.
Did you tour there at all with the band?
No, it was funny. We were supposed to go with LA Guns. And everything was supposed to get all set up. And I don't know how that fell out, but it did fall out. And I remember it was kind of a stupid reason kind of thing where something happened and we couldn't put it together. Because LA Guns and us, we got along really well together. You know,
that was another band that was very dysfunctional.
It was a very dysfunctional band. I remember Ken Annamani managed Damals for a little bit. And him and I were on the phone, and we were talking about what our next single should be off the Warped album. And Ken said, "We got to do Father Time." And I said, "There's no drums in it, Ken." He goes, "It's going to work. Trust me. We get in first, and then we sneak in through the back door, mm-hmm. and then the rest happens." He said, "LA Guns has a song coming out, Jane." And sure enough, they did that song, Jane. That saved them. If they didn't do Jane, they would just be like,
"Yeah, they'd have been a no-hit wonder."
Exactly.
Wow.
You know.
Let's go back to the Warped album again and play what was very big in the 80s, the power ballads.
Yes.
And this is called This Time It's Love, going back to the second and final album from Damals. Here it is.
This time it's love.
This time it's love. To hear the rest of this program, move on to the next stored audio file for part two with rocker turned author Billy McCarthy of DeMalls.